it's great to have the opportunity to talk to you guys. And it's, you know, it'd be wrong to start without remarking on what a great thing it is that you guys do. Every place you go, CERN or PI or any place with scientists, they all have a teacher that they, you know, were shaped by. So it's amazing what you guys do. So it's I'm glad to see you're here at the Einstein Plus. So I had this this last year has been actually it's been 15 months. I've been really having a great run this year. It's been a sabbatical. And I was at CERN until the end of March, March 20th, you'll see. That's an important date for the rest part of the story. And I had a sabbatical actually 7 years ago also at CERN. And both times it was when CERN was just starting. So the last time was when it was starting for its run one. And this is the time it's starting for run two. And it's kind of a, for particle physics, it's a, we're seeking a new direction and we're hoping that CERN will tell us. And so the sign on that, on the front slide is my favorite, second favorite slide in Europe. It kind of says that, it kind of says, toute direction is just, you know, basically I think it's through traffic. Everybody goes, supposed to go one way. It doesn't matter where you're going, go that way. And that kind of really is where we are now. We don't have any good sense of direction as to what which way to go. That's only my second favorite slide because next slide is my first favorite European sign. That sign is that's an example of how Britain and America are divided by common language, as they say. It's that's just outside Cambridge. It's in Cambridge near Damp. And of course, what they mean is a crosswalk with a speed bump. You know, actually, so now I'm seeing the slides now rather than seeing the audience, which is fine. I just I don't know what happened, but it's all good. All right, so next slide. So I'd like to talk about where the LHC goes, and part of that story is why they had to start it again. And so that'll be the first part, the apparatus part, talking about what the LHC is, how they broke it in 2009, and then how they fixed it. And what's happening now is they're just starting it again, having fixed it properly. Next slide. And so now, then I'll talk about the why they built it, which is a kind of a summary of the standard model, which is this theory which we have, which essentially describes all of physics if you combine it with general relativity. But all the non-gravitational physics is captured by the standard model. But it works really well until recently. There's a couple of things in it about it which we know now have to be wrong, and kind of that's why everyone's so excited about the LHC is that something has to happen. We think because we're pretty sure that the standard model is going to fail. And the next slide would be the experiment part talks about what they did in the first run. In the first run, the main thing they did is they found the Higgs particle, which I'll have introduced in the previous section. But what we're hoping now will be, so now the Higgs particle is boring. And so what we're hoping is that now they're going to find something different. And so there's really three classes of things that we think they're likely to find, and I'll tell you what those three are. If I run out of time, it'll be here, and so but that's probably not such a bad thing because the Higgs thing is in the bag, and the beyond stuff is a bit speculative. Next slide. So now I'm going to focus on what the LHC is. Next slide. And I guess I could have got these slides didn't really do much, did they? So we can do the next slide again. So we'll start off with here's the setting. So this is a picture actually I took on the flight pattern landing at the airport, which you can kind of see in the middle on the left-hand side of the screen. That's Geneva you're looking at there. Lake Geneva is just on the left. And the Alps, of course, in the background, and Mont Blanc is the highest one there. And now the next slide, the LHC would be that yellow ring. And the CERN site is that little triangle of buildings to the right of the yellow ring. And then the ATLAS site, which is one of the experiments at the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, is the one that's marked with the arrow there. It's just across the road from the main CERN site. That's where most of the Canadians, or in fact, all of the Canadian experimentalists work. And so most of the things I'll show you are coming from ATLAS, but it's one of several big experiments at the Large Hadron Collider. Next slide. It's as beautiful as you think it should be. This is a picture taken from the lab towards the mountains on a clear day, and it really is true that the Alps are spectacular. So next slide. So this is a cutaway view. it's underground, the LHC. It's 27 kilometers around. It's a big tube, and in it, protons, you know, hydrogen nuclei, are being accelerated in both directions. So there's, in that little circle you see called SPS, which stands for super proton synchrotron, which is underneath the, or it's basically at the CERN lab site. Protons are accelerated to a moderate speed, and then they're injected into this bigger ring, which is the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, and then they counter rotate. So there's two beams of protons, one going in each direction, and they are brought together at the places where the experiments are, four of which are shown in that figure here. Atlas and CMS are the two big ones. Atlas is the one that's right at the CERN site, and CMS is on the other side of the ring from it. And then LHCb and ALICE are two less general purpose detectors. They're kind of looking for specific things. I've lost the video. I don't know. Can you still see me?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. okay, next slide. So these protons are being accelerated until their kinetic energy is 7 TeV. That's their design energy. And for reference, a TeV is about 1,000 times the energy you would have if you took the proton mass and turned it into energy using E equals mc squared. So the main thing is that there's a lot of the energy, the kinetic energy of these protons is much, much more than the energy in their rest mass. And so they're very relativistic, and the rules of special relativity apply, very much so. And this is the highest energy accelerator on Earth. There are higher energy things hitting the Earth. Cosmic rays hit the Earth all the time with higher energies than this, but this is as best that people can do. And so each beam has 7 TeV. So when you collide them head to head, which is what will happen, they have a total of 14 TeV, tera electron volts, available to them. An electron volt is as you probably know, it's the amount of energy you get if you take an electron and you move it through a volt. So you've got much, much, much more than that energy. Next slide. So this is the beautiful thing, and there's the magnet next to it. this is a look at that down the tunnel. You have to get these protons to go in a circle, so you need magnets to do that, and they're superconducting magnets. So the whole 27 kilometers is at liquid helium temperatures, basically, which is, I think it's 1.7 degrees Kelvin. And so this picture is actually a complete fraud. It's actually very hard to get into the tunnel. You can get in to see the experiments when they're not running. So you can't now that they're running, but you could when I was there before they started running. But it's hard to get into the accelerator tunnel. So at one of the experiments at CMS, actually, they have a big poster of a life-size poster of what it looks like. And I stood in front of the poster to take this picture. So you can kind of see the wrinkled paper on the top right there. But it gives you a sense as to what the curvature of the ring is. It's very, very gradually turning because it's such a huge ring. And those magnets are an important part of the story because when it broke, it's the connections between the magnets that are what broke. Next slide. So here's a cross-section of the magnets, and you see the two side-by-side orange pipes are where the two proton beams would go. One would be going, say, into the slide, and one would be coming out of the slide. And at the places where the detectors are, they'd be brought together so that they could collide with each other. But this way, most of the ring, they just pass by each other. Next slide. So that's the machine, basically. And I want to switch over to talking about the detectors, which are kind of the experiments where they do the collisions. And so now we're looking at the slide, which says it's apparatus and is a picture of the CERN site. And what we're doing now is we're looking at that site looking away from the Alps. Kind of, this is the opposite point of view from the one that you looked at before, but it's closer up. And the Atlas buildings are the ones that are to the far right. And there's a little kind of round building there. Next slide, which is one that you might have seen in movies like Angels and Demons, where that's one of the public relations buildings at CERN. And so, to the left now, you should see a picture of what that looks like looking past that from the road. And there's a colorful building in the background. Next slide. Which, if you look at it close up, is the Atlas building. So that's the building that's over top of where the Atlas detector is, and they've painted the side of the building to look like the detector. That's kind of why it looks so colorful. But the building is actually smaller than the detector is. The building is about, as you can kind of see, it looks like it's a three-story building there. And the detector is more like a four-story building. So it's kind of it's similar in size to, but bigger than what you'd see there in this picture. And you see a guy walking on the far right of that picture. Just to his left is the control room for Atlas. If you go to the next slide, and then they've done this thing where they put in a plastic wall, a transparent plastic wall, so tourists can stand there and watch them as they work. It must be really bizarre for the people that are sitting on the far end, nearest to the where the picture is taken. You can kind of see a reflection there because it's taken through this plastic wall. And no one was there at the time, but I think it's the crappy seats must be the ones in front of the audience. But this is the place anyway where they control all the stuff that's going on. The detector is very impressive. They have a little Lego version of their detector in the public relations space on the other side of the plastic. So next slide. So if you kind of go to the next room in that building, and there's a big shaft. If you look down, then you're looking at what the actual detector and the scale of the thing is what these pictures won't convey very well. So the thing you should think of is the Peace Tower in Ottawa, and this shaft you're looking down. Imagine that you're at the top of the Peace Tower and you're looking down a hole which is the size of the Peace Tower, and the bottom what would be the East Block of Parliament is the detector. So it's like a four-story building and you're looking down on it from the roof, looking down kind of the length of the Peace Tower. That's the scale of what we're looking at here. So next slide. So here's we should be looking at the Atlas detector now. And the one on the left is a picture taken on my first sabbatical there in 2007, I guess, when they were finishing it off before it was started. And to get a size scale, those thing in the middle, the orangey things are magnets that are kind of useful for tracking the particles. But the silver thing in the middle has a scaffolding in front of it, and you see that there's like a three levels or four levels that people can stand on. It gives you an idea of the scale of what a person would be like there. And the one on the picture on the right was a picture I took a couple months ago, or I guess maybe it was last fall, just before they closed it up. And it's kind of a panorama of several pictures. So that's actually standing beside the detector and looking up, looking down, and I spliced a bunch of pictures together. But you can kind of see also there that there's a scaffolding at the very top, for instance, that gives you an idea how big that thing is. It's really an enormous detector. So there's this, if you saw the movie Particle Fever, they describe it as a I forget actually how much it weighs, but it was some number of tons Swiss watch, and that's really what it looks like. It's very, very intricate, but huge. Next slide. So this is a cutaway view of the detector, and it has all. It's big for a reason. So they're trying to see identify the particles that come out, and the main thing you need to know from that is to understand why the detectors are the way they are. Is that in these accelerators, there's when you collide the protons, what you might have thought, and what often is said, is you're seeing the ingredients of the proton spilling out when they collide with each other, and that's not quite true. That's partly true. You do see what's in the proton coming out, but there's so much energy in these collisions, and there has been really since the 30s, that when you produce, there's enough energy there that you start producing particles and their antiparticles from nothing. So the particles that are coming out needn't have been in the proton to start with, and that's kind of the good news, in that you don't need to kind of carefully choose which particles to collide to see what kind of particles there are. You're going to see all possible particles because they're all being produced in these very energetic collisions. But the bad news is that all the particles you produce, except for a handful of about six of them, are unstable. So they decay in about 10 to the minus 23 seconds. And even moving at the speed of light in 10 to the minus 23 seconds, you're lucky if you can cross a nucleus. So that means that none of the particles that are being produced that are new are actually getting out of the detector. They're all, the beams are coming in the axis of this detector, and they're colliding in the middle of that green thing. And when they collide, you know, they immediately decay into particles that are just run-of-the-mill particles we know about, like protons and electrons and photons and things like that. And so this detector is designed to tell apart the particles that are coming out, so to distinguish an electron from a photon, let's say, and then to tell where it came from, so that you can kind of reverse engineer the whole process and figure out what it was that was produced and decayed to produce these particles. So you're trying to measure their energy and their momentum and the species of particle you're looking at. And that's done because the different areas in this detector with different colors, particles of different types interact differently with the material. So if you're electrically charged, for example, you'll lose energy more efficiently than if you're not electrically charged. Or if you take part in the strong interactions, then you scatter kind of very strongly compared to if you don't take part in the strong interactions, and things like that. So the different that kinds of particles will light up different parts of the detector, and people identify the kinds of particles based on who lights up. So the next few slides show you kind of which parts light up for different kinds of particles. So the next slide is electrons. Electrons, the very middle part is designed, if you have an electric charge, it'll actually make a track, the particle, so you'll see it and you'll see where it went. And then the green thing is something of which will stop electrons, and it'll stop photons too, because they are not very heavy and they don't take part in, mostly because they're not very heavy. So that's called the electromagnetic calorimeter, the green thing. So now next slide. So a photon is like an electron, except it's not electrically charged from the point of view of the detector. So you don't see it in the middle part, but you do see it in the green part, and that's how you tell the two apart, if you just see those two things light up and not anything outside. Next slide. So a proton, because it's heavier, goes farther, and it kind of punches through to the orange thing, which is called the hadronic calorimeter, and that's where it stops. And you can measure the amount of energy it deposits there. The fact that it stops, if they're big, kind of they want to stop the whole thing and capture all the energy. So the next slide shows you then what a neutron does. It's like a proton, but it has no charge, so you don't see it in the middle part. The next slide shows you what a muon does. A muon is like an electron, but heavier. And because it's like an electron, it's heavier, it goes farther, but it's unlike a proton, it doesn't take part in the strong interaction, so it actually goes right through the whole orange thing. It even escapes the detector. And so the blue things on the outside are there to tell you that something went through, either going in or going out, and those are called the muon detectors. And then the next slide shows you that there's neutrinos, and you don't see them at all. If you produce a neutrino, which is a very light particle, which is sometimes produced in reactions, it interacts extremely weakly with things. It's so weakly that they're produced. So I think the nuclear reactions that light the sun, they produce neutrinos all the time, and at such an incredible rate that even at the center, at the surface of the Earth, so you know, we're 8 light minutes from the sun, every square centimeter. So if you make a little ring with your fingers, there's something like 10 billion neutrinos pass through that every second from the sun, and the fact that we aren't even aware of that is a reflection of how weakly they interact. So you can't really see them in these detectors. You have to have a specially designed detector just to see them. But anyway, so the way you tell that they're there, if all the other particles you do see come out one side, say, you know, something went out the other side, and so then you can infer that the neutrinos, that there was a neutrino in that process. But it's kind of a, because of that, you have to have this thing be hermetic, so you don't miss any of the particles you could have seen. You want to make sure you did see them, so that if you are missing something, you know that you really did miss something, and it wasn't just a crack in your detector. Okay, next slide. So here's a picture of a real event in which this is a computer readout of what they would see, and this one has two electrons and two muons coming out, and you can kind of see that all the detectors on the outside of the detector went off, and that was the muons, and the other lines describe other particles which didn't get out, and there's more than just four lines there, so there are other particles besides these two electrons and two muons, which is typical. Next slide. Normally you get something like this, where there's a whole, what's scientifically called a shitload of particles come out. This one is actually a Higgs event. So there was a Higgs that was produced, and you're kind of, the picture is you're looking down the detector along the axis. So the collision happened in the middle, and you can't really measure very effectively things along that axis, because all the junk in the proton kind of goes along after the collision, goes along the axis of the beam. And so the most interesting information is transverse to the beam, and that's what that's why these pictures are like that. But you can kind of see that there are four things that came out the outside. Those are the muons, but there's a whole bunch of other things going on at the same time. So you can kind of appreciate the experimentalists have a real job trying to pick apart what happened in these collisions. Next slide. Okay, so that's the accelerator and the detectors, or at least one of them. The other one is a similar kind of design. And they all have kind of the same kind of features, but they're optimized in different ways. But ATLAS is kind of a general purpose, see everything detector. So now I want to talk about how they broke it back in 2009. So actually, yeah, 2000, I guess the fall of 2008 was when they broke it. I know that because I left CERN in August, and they broke it in September, I think, or October, and I kind of felt good that I had an alibi. So I want to tell you how they broke it. So you remember that there's thousands of these magnets that are at liquid helium temperatures, and they're there to keep the protons going in a circle. And this is a picture of them. I don't know if I said next slide or not, but we're looking at the picture, which says LHC 2003 on it. And it's a picture of a bunch of the magnets before they were installed, on when they were still on the surface. Next slide. And so this is now the join picture of the connection between two of the magnets. And yet, just to show you that it's a complicated thing. Next slide. And now this is a close-up of, there's a copper bus bar that kind of goes through the and connects all the different magnets. And the bottom of the picture is an X-ray of those bus bars, showing that where they've been welded to each one another, and it's showing where there, some of the welds weren't very good. And that turned out to be the problem that the, that caused the thing to break. Next slide. So what that bus bar is it's that's actually, you remember these things are kept at that liquid helium temperatures because they have to superconduct. And so at liquid helium temperatures, that copper bus bar is there because it's the insulation on the wiring. Normally we use copper as the conductor in a wire, in normal wires, but in superconducting wires, copper is not superconducting. So it's not actually a very good in, good at carrying current compared to the superconductor. And so in this schematic, in this picture, the red line that runs left to right is supposed to be the superconducting current. And the yellow thing is the copper bus bar, and that's there to keep the current, just to wrap the current and separate it from the rest of the magnet. And the important thing about it is that it's not really doing anything as long as everything's working. But what happens with these superconducting magnets is that every once in a while, for some reason, the coolant system fails, and one of these magnets will go above liquid helium temperatures and will no longer superconduct. And when that happens, the current has to go somewhere. And so the copper is there to be a place for the current to go. That's why it's such a big thing, and not do any damage when it does that. And so, next slide. So that's called a quench. When the magnet is no longer cold enough to superconduct, the current moves into the copper bus bar. And you can kind of see that that's all great as long as you don't have any bad welds between the different magnets. But the next slide shows you that if you do have bad welds, when the current goes into the copper, it can't get to the next magnet, and then it has to go somewhere. And so it's like a truck hitting the, it just picks up this whole detector, the whole magnet, and it moves it over. It's screwed into the concrete, but it picks it up and moves it over, and it completely destroys the setup. And so what happened when they turned it on was it worked fine for a couple days because none of the magnets quenched. But as soon as a couple magnets quenched, the fact that they had bad welds between these magnets caused the catastrophic failure. And then once you take one of these magnets and you move it sideways, it takes the next one with it, the next one with it, and then a whole bunch of junk goes down the vacuum tube. The whole tube that the protons are in is supposed to be evacuated, so there's no air for the protons to hit. And of course, that gets ruined. So it was a big disaster when they did it. And of course, it's hard to fix because the whole thing is at liquid helium temperature. So you have to actually warm everything up. And you can't warm the whole thing up at once, partly because there's no place to put the helium. If you boil it, helium's expensive now, it turns out, but they don't have enough storage for it. And so so they can only warm it up 1/8 at a time. And so it's a big deal to have to fix things. Everything takes much longer than it otherwise would have. Next slide. So they did, back in 2009, they fixed the ones that broke catastrophically. But they didn't fix all of them because the whole ring would have taken too long. And once they knew what the problem was, they could tell. Next slide. They could tell by looking at the measuring the resistance between the magnets which ones had bad connections, even the ones that were still kept at liquid helium temperature. So the resistance was very small; it was nano ohms. But they could measure it once they knew what they're looking for, and so they had an idea how many of the magnets they had not fixed had a problem. And because of that, they were fairly sure that if they ran it at only half the energy that they're supposed to run at, they could run it and not have a catastrophic failure again. So what they decided to do was, rather than shut it down and spend a couple of years fixing the whole thing, they decided to do that half fix and then turn it on and run it at half the energy that it was designed for. And the reason they did that is that they knew that they could settle the issue of whether or not there was a Higgs particle or not. They didn't need a lot of energy for that. They needed just lots of collisions. And so they decided to try and run in the first run at not the full design energy. And that's kind of what they've been doing until they shut down a couple years ago. And in the shutdown that they've just had, they were fixing all the rest of the magnets that had not been fixed. And so the run that's starting now is the first run that's really at the design energy that they've intended to run at. It's going to be actually starting off a little bit less. They're going to run it 13 TeV rather than 14, but it's that's just to, while they're warming up. And so it's that's kind of why much of the things you look for depend on how much energy you have available in your collisions. And the reason why the run that they're starting now is so much more exciting, even though they've been running before, is because they have more energy available to them. And the reason they didn't have the energy available to them before was because of the fact that they broke it when they turned it on the first time. Okay, next slide. So that brings us to this last spring. So this is an email message they sent us all on March 24th. Remember, I left CERN on March 20th. So they were supposed to start, like March 22nd, I think, to run the beam for the they put everything together and it was all supposed to go, and then this email was announcing that they had had another problem. So there's another one of these oh shit moments where it seemed like there was going to be a big deal, that they had some sort of a short circuit in one of these magnets again, and they couldn't figure out why, and it looked like it was going to. And what it says in this message is that if it hadn't been at liquid helium temperatures, they could probably fix it in a couple days, but it might take weeks or months. And so if you go to the next slide, you see that they fixed it much faster than they thought. So just in a matter of days, they fixed it. And it turns out that they did the analog of hitting it on the side with a hammer. They had a short circuit, and they figured, well, maybe that's some sort of a small particle that got stuck between where an insulator is supposed to be. So they put an enormous voltage through it really quickly, and it evaporated the particle, apparently. And so because of that, they didn't need to shut it down and warm it up and fix everything, and they were able to fix it in a matter of days rather than weeks or months. And so the next slide was they turned it on June 3rd, and it is really running, and it seems to be working, and everything is going well, and they're at the 13, they're at the 13 TeV goal that they wanted to be at, and the detectors are running, and so now the physics run has happened. So since last fall to June 3rd, they've been kind of putting beam in various parts of the detector and then making sure that the accelerator works. And at the same time, the experimentalists were making sure the detectors work. But now they're doing a physics run where they're taking data, and they haven't told us yet what they've seen, but they're accumulating data as we speak. Next slide. Okay, so why are they doing all this? So that's about the Standard Model. Next slide. Here's another. I guess I didn't need the second slide, so next slide again. So the Standard Model is our theory of kind of what's going on. And the great thing, Standard Model has been the curse for people that are my age, because it was invented in the late 60s, early 70s. And then it's worked really, really well until the first signs that it was failing, definitive signs, were kind of in the late 90s. And so in the meantime, if you're in the business of finding new theories, you didn't really need one. And so, but now it started to fail, but it's our theory of the world in the sense that it's the description of the fundamental constituents from which things are made and the interactions through which they interact. And then all the larger things are built up of those. And so not all questions, of course, can be answered by asking kind of what are you made of? But, some questions can, and most of the descriptions of what's going on at larger scales use properties of things that are coming from the fact that they're made of smaller things. And are in that chain of logic, the Standard Model is our endpoint, as far as we know. It's a description of the smallest things we have. So there's, in that picture, there's sheep, there's cells, there's a chromosome there, and there's an atom. And then inside the atom, there's a nuclei, and the nuclei are made of protons and neutrons. And inside the protons and neutrons are quarks, like up and down quarks. And then the goal is, by knocking things together, even at higher energies, to see what things are. What are the things that are out there from which things are made, and how do they interact? Next slide. The people who invented the Standard Model are these three people. That's Sheldon Glashow, Abdus-Salam, and Steven Weinberg. Glashow kind of had a precursor of the theory in the early 60s, and then Weinberg and Salam came up with the model as it's kind of used now. And the difference between the two of them was that they didn't understand what turned out to be the Higgs mechanism, which is a big part of our story here, what the Higgs particle is. All right, next slide. So the Standard Model involves the particles on that list there. This is where we're looking at the quarks, the green quarks, the blue leptons, and the red bosons. So the the things on the left, the what are called fermions, are the things from which matter is made. And the quarks, the first column on the left-hand side is what all the ordinary matter is made out of. The up and down quarks are what protons and neutrons are made from. And the electron is in that column too. And the neutrino that goes with it appears in radioactive decays. And almost all of everyday experience is just that left-hand column. But the next two columns are there, and they have the same properties as the first column, it turns out, all the charges that the first column has, but they're just more massive. So it's like three copies of everything. It's like Mother Nature is a bureaucrat. Everything's in triplicate. And so the other things are heavy. They're produced normally in accelerators, but they decay. And then the bosons are the ones that mediate forces. So the photon mediates the electromagnetic force. The gluon mediates the strong force that binds together the nucleus, and then the weak bosons, the Z and the W, are the things that are responsible for radioactive decays and stuff like that. And that's the picture. Everything seems to fit into that picture. The Standard Model has one more thing in it, and until two years ago, we used to say it was missing. Next slide. But the other thing that's in the Standard Model is the Higgs boson, and now it's been found. So now the way you'd give this talk is you say, everything in the Standard Model that's supposed to be there is there. They've all been seen, and that's true, as far as we know. Next slide. So, but the Higgs boson took a long time to find. And so it was kind of inferred to be there in the 60s, and that was kind of that happened kind of between Glashow and Weinberg and Salam's work. And so now we're looking at a picture of Peter Higgs. He's the one for whom the Higgs boson is named. It's the only particle that's named after a person. And then the other six people are the other people who also invented it. So the first, in the top row there, the two guys who got the Nobel Prize are the guy in the middle of the top row, Englert, and then Peter Higgs. And then the guy on the left of the top row, Braut, would have gotten it too, except he had died before it was discovered. And then the other four have a shot at also getting credit for it, and but you can only give it to three people, and so the decision was made just to give it to the two survivors of the top left three. There's a story there, which is an interesting story, but I think it's fair what happened. Next slide. So the idea of the Higgs mechanism was that there was a puzzle in the Standard Model. And if you had the Standard Model without the Higgs particle in it, which is kind of what they tried to do, what Glashow tried to do, it turns out that it predicts that all the particles that we see should be massless and that they should move at the speed of light, which we know is wrong. And so the puzzle was always, the reason Glashow knew he wasn't finished yet was that he didn't know, there was a prediction there that had to be wrong, and he wasn't quite sure how to fix it. And what Higgs and these other guys did was they figured out how to fix the problem. And then it was kind of a very deep thing that they suggested. They suggested that there's another boson, there's another force in the problem besides the ones that I listed, the photons and the Z bosons and the W bosons and the gluons. There's also this Higgs boson. So it's like a force, but the difference between it and the other ones is that it's a force, the Higgs particle mediates a force like all the other ones do, but it has the property that if you don't have anything, normally if you have a force like a magnetic force, if you don't have a magnet there, the force goes away because there's less energy not having the force than there is. It costs you more energy to have the force than it does to not have the force if you don't have the sources there that give rise to it. And what happens with the Higgs particle, the Higgs force, is that it has the feature that it can be present even if there are no sources for it. So if you take away all the particles and you look at the vacuum, normally that would not have any force fields in it, like the magnetic field, but it does have the Higgs field, and is what the proposal was. So they proposed that the vacuum is much like a physical thing. It was like a fluid, and so that we're living inside this vacuum, which has a field. And when you look at the properties of particles, you should be taking into account the fact they're moving through this fluid when you're figuring out how massive they should be, for example, because particles will interact with the fluid, and that interaction energy will look like a mass because energy and mass are the same thing. And if you didn't know the fluid was there, you don't know it's an interaction energy. You just say that's a mass. That's an energy the particle has when nothing else is around. And so their picture was you could understand why particles have a mass, but you can only do it if you said that there's another field around which is filling space in the vacuum, And the masses that you see are the interaction energies of these particles with that vacuum. That's their picture. So it's like trying to understanding particles without knowing about the Higgs field is like understanding fish without knowing about water. You miss a lot. Next slide. And of course, different things interact differently with the vacuum. And so that's kind of an explanation as to why their masses are different is the picture. The picture of the gorilla is misleading because you should not think of it as being friction. It's not like you're pushing through and being slowed down by drag because there's no friction in the vacuum. But it's more that you're interacting with the vacuum and different things interact by a different amount. And that energy you interpret as mass. Now, next slide. Now, the Higgs particle, as opposed to the Higgs field, is just a wave in the fluid. If you were living in a fluid like water, you could jiggle it and you could see a change in the properties of the fluid move by you. And that same thing is true for the Higgs field. And those particles in quantum mechanics, those waves in quantum mechanics look like particles in the same way that an electromagnetic wave looks like photons if you look at it closely. And so the analog of the wave in the Higgs field, the analog of a photon for an electromagnetic wave for a wave in the Higgs field is the Higgs particle. And so the thing that was seen, as you'll see in a second in the LHC in its last run, was these waves in the vacuum. So it's not just like another particle, just one more particle. It's really kind of a the fact that they've seen this Higgs particle is a very deep statement about what the vacuum looks like. It's a vindication of this Higgs mechanism. Next slide. So this is a picture now of a graph, and really all this is supposed to do is to convince you that it's not just we sit around and we say, oh, we like our theory, and then we go and have a beer. There really is a precision sense in which the standard model works. And so this is a plot of the interaction rate where you take electrons and positrons, which are the antiparticles of electrons, and you collide them together, and they annihilate into things. And in this case, it's looking at hadrons, which are just anything that takes part in the strong interaction, so anything made of quarks. And the curve is what the theory predicts, and the dots are all different experiments that were done over the years by different accelerators. And the red ones are the accelerator that previously was in the same tunnel as the LHC is in now. And you see that it works really, really well. And across the bottom is the energy of the collision. And so the rate changes in this dramatic way, which is precisely captured by what they measure. Next slide. So that sounds great. It's a great theory. It passes many tests. So why do we think it's wrong? Next slide. So there's two kinds of things that make us think the theory is wrong. One class of things is observational problems it has, and that's what this slide is talking about. So there's two things that we know that the standard model gets wrong observationally. One of them is the sun sends us neutrinos. I told you there's kind of 10 billion neutrinos going through every square centimeter at the surface of the Earth every second. But it turns out that if you calculate precisely how many neutrinos, so people, the way that's, you can predict how many neutrinos there should be because you know how much energy the sun produces and you know what reactions are producing that energy. But you can also measure the neutrinos. And so people have made detectors that measure neutrinos, and they're amazing things. They have one in a mine in Sudbury, which is one of the best ones. And it is huge tanks of water, or in that case, it's heavy water. And what they do is the neutrinos, they're very hard to see, but every once in a while, you know, one in a million of them will hit something in the water, and then you detect the reaction that it causes. And what happened when they did that was, for many years, was they found that they were always getting about a third as many neutrinos from the sun. The good news was they saw the neutrinos from the sun, so they knew that the basic picture of how the sun shines was right. But they were getting not quite as much as they should. They were always finding about a third as many neutrinos as they thought they should be getting from the sun, and couldn't figure out quite why. And so now we know why, because this detector in Sudbury, in this mine, was the first detector that was capable of measuring all three kinds of neutrinos. You remember, the standard model brings us everything in triplicate, so there's more than one kind of neutrino, there's three kinds. But the standard model predicts that the reactions that are taking place inside the sun should only be producing one of those three species. But the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory is capable of measuring all three kinds. And what they found was that all three kinds are actually arriving from the sun. And if you only looked at the kinds that people had been looking for before, which was the ones that were expected to come, the electron neutrinos, you only got about a third of what you expected. But when you add up all the three species of neutrinos, they're all coming, and they sum up to the right amount, given how much energy the sun is putting out. So that's something which the standard model gets wrong. The standard model would say it should be impossible that you should get the other two neutrino species from the sun, but it turns out you get them. And people have verified this by producing neutrino beams on Earth and also seen that you can get surprises where you think you only have one type of neutrino, but you measure more than one type of neutrino once you put a detector there. So we know that there's something funny going on with the neutrinos, that the standard model gets wrong. It might be that they just have a mass, but whatever it is, the standard model gets it wrong. The other thing that the standard model gets wrong is the right-hand picture, the pie chart there. And what that is that's really a summary of everything that NIOSH told you earlier in his talk earlier in the week, that they're having this wonderful time in cosmology. They for the first time ever, they're able to they have this very consistent model that they also call the standard model, but we called ours the standard model first. But they have a standard model and it works really well, but it only works really well if you can actually use its success to survey what's out there in the universe. And the big surprise is that only 5% or 4% of what's out there is anything that the standard model tells you about. So any matter we understand is only at most 4% of what's out there. And all the rest of it is inferred to be there because of what it does gravitationally. And there's two kinds of stuff, dark matter and dark energy, that he certainly told you about. And no one has any idea what they are, really. And you have to change either the standard model to give yourself new matter, or you have to change gravity to change what you would infer is there. But something has to change. And cosmologists sometimes say, well, maybe the solution to that problem is not particle physics, because maybe gravity changed. But I can tell you that no matter how you solve that problem, particle physicists will call it particle physics, because we own everything, we think. And so if it turns out that gravity is what's changing, that's particle physics to us. So we're going to have to figure out how gravity works. So there really is something, the theory of the world that says that the standard model and general relativity are describing everything we see, until about 20 years ago, there was no evidence against that statement. But now there's several kinds of evidence that there's something wrong. And so the question is, what is wrong, and what's the theory that works better? And next slide. There's also theoretical problems, which I'll come back to a little bit later. Next slide. The top two are the most important. These are called the hierarchy problems, and the other ones are like, who ordered all this? Why are there three copies of everything? What about gravity? How do you reconcile gravity and quantum mechanics? Those are all important problems, but they may not get solved until we get to very high energies. Kind of the most pressing problem is what has to change, or does anything have to change at the energies that you can measure experimentally, like in the Large Hadron Collider? And the hierarchy problem is a problem which it's believed that the standard model is telling us something has to happen at the energies that the Large Hadron Collider can reach. And so that's why I want to focus on it as the of all these theoretical problems, as the problem which is the one that's driven most of the thinking about what the LHC could look for. Next slide. So what about the experiment? So I want to first briefly talk about the Higgs, and then close out with what these other things are that we could be looking for. And that'll include a brief statement of what the hierarchy problem was that I just alluded to. All right, so now what about the Higgs? Next slide. And again, I've got too many slides here. I don't need this Higgs beyond slide. Next slide. So here's a picture of Higgs going to two photons, it turns out. And this was part of the discovery. This is this Higgs that's been missing for so long. People knew that if the standard model was right, basically they knew roughly what its mass, the mass of the Higgs had to be. It had to lie in a range of somewhere between 115 times or so more massive than the proton, and it couldn't be heavier than about 200 times more massive than the proton. So in that range it had to be, and that's kind of why they knew that the LHC could decide if it was there or not. They didn't need to worry about not having all the energy available, because they knew that the Higgs, if the standard model was right, had a mass that was light enough that you could produce it at the energies that they had available to them in their first run. So they knew that they could decide if the Higgs is there or not, and what they seem to have found is that the Higgs is there, and it behaves the way the standard model behaves. And so the next few slides are the evidence for that. Next slide. So the problem is, you're looking for the Higgs. It's not like it just has a flag which says, you know, I'm the Higgs. The problem is that you look at the Higgs, it decays very quickly into something like two photons, but every second thing that happens in the LHC can produce two photons. And so you have this needle in the haystack problem that you're trying to find things that are really like dirt. And it's worse than that. It's worse than a needle in a haystack. You're looking for a needle in a haystack that decays into hay after 10 to the minus 23 seconds. And so it's really a tribute that they can find it at all. And that's why it took a while to find, because they have to find carefully the pairs of photons that came from a Higgs and distinguish them from the ones that didn't come from a Higgs. So how do they do that? Next slide. So this is a picture, the graph is a picture of the rate with which things produce two photons at the LHC. And the vertical axis is kind of the number of times you're seeing two photons. And the horizontal axis is a measure of the energy of the two photons. And I'll tell you exactly what the measure is in a second. So now the thing is that if you're looking at the photons that came from the Higgs, the thing that's special, if a Higgs decays into two photons, the simplest place to think about it is to think about the rest frame of the Higgs. So imagine the Higgs was just sitting there, like in the bottom left, and it turns into two photons. And what will happen is that momentum conservation will force those two photons to come out in opposite directions with exactly the same momentum, in opposite directions, but the same magnitude of momentum. And because they have the same magnitude of momentum, they'll have exactly the same energy. And so because they have exactly the same energy, and that energy had to come from the Higgs, and the Higgs was not moving, the energy of each photon will be exactly half the energy you would get from using E equals MC squared from the rest mass of the Higgs. So half the mass of the Higgs will go into the energy of each photon. But the problem is that only will happen in the rest frame of the Higgs. And if you produce a Higgs, it'll be moving probably, because it'll be moving, you know, you'll collide it and a Higgs will shoot off in some direction. So what they do is they take these two, in this plot on the top right, they take these two photons that they see coming out, and they say, well, if I imagine transforming to the frame of reference where these two photons were back to back, so they're moving opposite from one another, so they might have been coming from a Higgs decay, then I'll ask, what's the sum of the two photon energies in that rest frame? And that's what's being plotted across the bottom there. And the reason they do that is that all the ones that come from a Higgs decay will have exactly the same energy in that kind of a plot. And so what they've done, the little red thing there is a simulation of how many photons they should have seen if the Higgs had a mass of 130 GeV. Remember, GeV is the mass of a proton. And so you can kind of see that ideally, if you had a whole bunch of Higgs decaying, you'd get a bump happening at one spot. So if you just see one event with two photons coming out, you don't know anything. You can't tell if that came from a Higgs or came from some other process. But if you do many, many, many measurements of photons coming out and you see a bump where a whole bunch are piling up in this kind of a plot at one spot, that's evidence that there was a particle decaying, and the mass of that particle will be where the bump is. That's kind of how they decide if there's a Higgs there or not. And next slide, what they found was the bump. So they did that, essentially what I told you. And the first thing they found in 2012 was that they started, both detectors, CMS and Atlas, started to see a bump at the same place. And it was not at 130, but it was at 125 GeV, it turned out. And so that's the evidence that there's something there. It doesn't tell you right away that it's a Higgs, but it says that it's something at that mass that decays into two photons. Next slide. So we know right away that that thing is what we call a boson, something that can mediate a force, because only that can make two photons. It has to have spin zero or two, because the photon has spin one, and only that can conserve angular momentum. It's got to be electrically neutral, because the photons don't carry a charge. And then we know what its mass is. And that's kind of all we know. That's what we know for free, just by the fact that they saw something. But it doesn't in itself tell us it's the Higgs. Next slide. So now what we want to know is it the Higgs, which is the Higgs the standard model predicts, or is it a Higgs, which is if you have a theory that's different from the standard model, all the theories we know understand mass in the same way. They all say the vacuum has this field in it, but the details of the field can change from theory to theory. And so people talk about Higgses in a more general way than the specific standard model Higgs. And so people, as soon as they found something, they wanted to know, is this the one that the standard model predicts, or is it something else? Next slide. So this is the slide that they show now in the conferences this summer. This is the Atlas version of it, but the CMS also has one. And what they do is the way that they decide if it's the Higgs or not is they ask the Higgs, the standard model predicts the Higgs decays into various things like two photons or two Z bosons or two W bosons or two tau leptons. And it predicts that it'll all happen in a very specific rate. And so what they do is they measure, they've now seen all those decays, and they measure the rate with which they happen, and they ask, is it happening with the speed the standard model tells you it should happen? And in this plot, what they're plotting there is they're plotting the rate for those various decays to happen that they measure, and they divide it by the prediction of the standard model. So one on that plot is what the standard model predicts, so that's the red line. And so the green arrow is the green bar is more or less the experimental measurement for each one, and that's what they would say is a one sigma error. So that's a 66% of the time you should be inside that green band. And so broadly speaking, you want the green band to fall on top of the red line everywhere, and you can see that it basically does. It's the ones on the bottom there, the Higgs goes to two muons, those are such rare decays that it's not a very precise measurement because the green band is so wide, but the ones at the top are actually quite good. And so you see that all the evidence now is that this really is a standard model vanilla Higgs. It really does seem to be doing everything that the standard model says it should be doing. And that's kind of, I think, what people, that's the consensus that's forming now, is that it's very much a standard model Higgs. So what they found is it seems to be the standard model, the missing standard model Higgs. Next slide. So it seems like it's, you know, it looks like a duck, it walks like a duck, smells like a duck, tastes like a duck, so it's probably a duck. But the next slide shows you that it might not be a duck. So people still look at it carefully. So the evidence is building that it's a standard model Higgs, but it'll continue to build and as the next run happens, because they have much more of these Higgses being produced all the time. And one of the things they're going to do is keep an eye on it to make sure that it's still doing what it's supposed to do. So next slide. So now what else is there? And I know that we're running quite low on time here, so I should be brief here. Next slide. So how do you guess what you replace the standard model with? So the guideline is mostly is you take a problem. In particular, it's going to be this hierarchy problem I'm going to explain in a second, and you ask kind of what would you have to change in the standard model to fix that problem, because we think it's a problem that needs fixing. And then that suggests three categories of things that people look for. And so all the various theories that people talk about tend to fall into these three broad classes. And so the best thing would be if they find something that's in none of the classes, because that would mean that we're just completely wrong about this hierarchy problem, and we'll have to see what happens. But right now, the best guess is it'll be one of these three things. Next slide. So the problem is this problem of why is gravity so different from everything else? And so one way of phrasing the question is that if you know the Higgs mass, the Higgs is responsible for all masses. So all the masses of all the particles in the particle physics part of the problem are similar, and the Higgs is one of the heaviest ones. It's not the heaviest ones. The top quark is a little bit heavier, but they're all kind of 100 GeV or less in mass. And one way, and so that sets the scale of all the non-gravitational interactions we know of, and in particular the weak interactions, the rate with which they happen is controlled by the W boson mass, it turns out. And that's historically was parameterized in terms of a coupling constant called the Fermi coupling constant, which is what I'm calling G sub F in this plot, in this slide. And that's measured to be about 1 over 100 GeV squared. So the number doesn't matter, but it's just a measure of how strong the weak interactions is set by the mass of the Higgs and the W boson and everything else. But if you compare that to the strength of gravity, the gravity's strength, there's the coupling constant that measures gravity strength is Newton's constant, the one that we, you know, you measure in school labs. And it has the same dimensions as this weak interaction coupling constant, and it's much, much smaller. It's both those, the Fermi coupling constant and Newton's constant are 1 over a mass scale squared, and the Planck mass is the one that sets Newton's constant, and that's a much larger mass than the one that comes from the particle physics, which means to say, another way of saying that the gravity is much weaker than all the other interactions, including the weak interaction. And not by just a little bit. The Planck mass is 10 to the 19th GeV. GeV is the mass of a proton, remember. Whereas the weak scale is 100 times the mass of a proton. So gravity is 1 over that squared. So it's something like 10 to the 36 times weaker than the weak interactions, which are already very weak compared to other interactions we know. So the question is, why is that? And that sounds like a question which, you know, maybe we'll know, maybe we won't know. It doesn't sound like it's a very urgent question, but there's a sense in which it's urgent, and that's what the next slide is supposed to argue. So next slide. Oh, sorry, the slide after this, we'll argue that. This is just saying that another way of phrasing the question, why is gravity weak, is it's asking, why are astrophysical objects large? The reason that the sun is so big compared to the proton or to us is that the physics that controls its size is a competition between gravity and some other interaction, in this case, the nuclear reactions that drive the sun. And because gravity is so weak, you need a lot of other things to balance it in order for it to balance. And so it turns out the mass of the sun is something like the Planck mass cubed divided by the proton mass squared. And you can derive that formula by asking for hydrostatic equilibrium between the nuclear forces and the strength of gravity trying to hold everything together. And so it really turns out that the weakness of gravity is why galaxies and things are big. And so it's the question that you're asking is a question of why is there such hierarchies of scale between gravitationally controlled things and other ones. Next slide. So now, why is that a pressing problem is what's missing. And so you remember, you're supposed to think of the vacuum as like a medium. It's like water. And so water, you could freeze it, you could boil it, and it changes phase. And this is a picture of a phase diagram of water, where the vertical axis is pressure and the horizontal axis is temperature. And you know, I always forget where atmospheric pressure is, but it's atmospheric pressure is kind of halfway up there. And so if you kind of raise the temperature, you go from solid to liquid and then eventually to vapor. And there's a famous point, which is the triple point. So if you take the vapor-liquid coexistence curve, it eventually ends at some point. If you go to very high temperatures and you change the pressure, you go right from, you don't really have this dramatic change between liquid and vapor anymore. And that happens at about 600 and something degrees, you can kind of see Kelvin. That point, you know, where that happens is that triple point, critical point for water. You can calculate where that should be, given that you know the energies involved in the interactions amongst all the water molecules. And so where these transitions happen is very characteristic of the energies involved in the interactions that are responsible for, say, changing liquid to vapor. So next slide. So if it happened that somebody told you that, you know, without changing any of the interactions of water, if they told you that triple point the critical point for water, if they told you that it was at 10 to the minus 15 degrees, that would be a big surprise, because that would make it not related in a normal way with the scales that are essentially responsible for the interactions that are giving you that phase transition. And what we have with the standard model is like a situation where it's like we're being told there's a phase transition at very, very low energies compared to what it should be. You know, if you think of the scales in the problem, the Planck scale is a scale that we know nature has, and it seems like the standard model is very much looks like the low energy limit of something more fundamental, and we know that there are other scales that are larger than the scales we see in particle physics. So it seems like there's fundamental interactions going on at very high energies, and but this Higgs is describing some phase transition like water. It should be characterized by the basic scale that's describing this microscopic interaction, and that scale we think is actually much higher than the scales that we measure in particle physics. And so the fact that we actually measure a very small Higgs mass is like, it's as if we're measuring that the phase transition for the Higgs is at very, very low temperatures compared to the basic scales that we think nature is described by. So that's the hierarchy problem. It's a puzzle. It's not like you can write down 1,000 theories and some of them would have gravity be very weak and other ones wouldn't compared to the Higgs scale. When you write down theories, it tends to be that they all have the same scale. If you write down a theory of gravity and the Higgs boson, it's difficult to make theories where they're very different in scale, the Planck mass and the Higgs mass. And so the fact that the standard model gives us an answer, which is for the Higgs mass, which is much smaller than the scale that gravity points towards, is a puzzle, theoretically. And that's the puzzle that people are trying to fix when they make other changes to the standard model. Next slide. So there's three ways in which people have tried to understand that problem. One is the historically conservative way. That's to say, well, maybe the Higgs is made of something smaller, and in the same way that protons are made of smaller things like quarks. The people who believe this still believe it, really, but most of them are kind of bummed out by the Higgs, because they, before the Higgs was discovered, would have predicted that the Higgs should not like to decay into photons and into W's and Z's, but those have all been seen now. And so now they're all being forced into a corner of parameter space in their theories, which makes the Higgs look like the standard model Higgs. And these theories were designed to change the standard model and to change the Higgs in particular in an important way. And so I think most people think that these are models that are either, if they're not dead yet, they're coughing up blood. So they're in bad shape. Okay, so next slide. So now the most popular approach was supersymmetry, where you imagine that every particle has a partner called a superpartner, And it, in particular, these models predict that there's more than one thing that looks like the Higgs. And so they, and the one that looks like the Higgs the most should have been light. And 125 GeV is actually quite hard to get. It's on the high side. It's not crazy, but it's kind of on the high side for these models. But these models, they predict, the next slide, besides the properties of the Higgs, they predict all these other particles that should be there. Every particle has a partner. The electron has a partner called the selectron, which is like the short for the supersymmetric electron. The top quark has a partner, which is called the supersymmetric top or the stop, and so on. And then these people are all kind of bummed out because they hoped the LHC was going to find these particles. They hoped the Higgs would be light. They hoped that there'd be more than one of them. And they hoped that there'd be lots of other super partners, and they haven't found any yet. So the next slide is the joke. The joke is that there's only one stop in scene at CERN, and that's a picture of it. So those people are also kind of they're finding corners of parameter space where they can make their theory work, and that these particles are there, but they're heavy for some reason. We haven't seen them yet, and that's kind of where they live. Next slide. So the last proposal is to say that we were misled in thinking that gravity was actually much different from the weak interactions. There's a way you can understand gravity as being the Planck mass could have been. It could be that gravity is stronger than we think it is, that it might be the same strength as the weak interactions, but you can only do that if you have extra dimensions, because if you have more than the three space dimensions, force lines of gravity could all spread out in the dimensions you're not seeing and make it appear to be weaker than it really is. But that only works if the extra dimensions are as big as they could possibly be, and you would start seeing the effects of these extra dimensions at the LHC, one hopes. Now, these people, I have not a sad face or a happy face here, because before they turned the LHC on, these people knew that they were not expecting to see the extra dimensions at the energies that the LHC was running in run one, because there are other constraints coming from astrophysics that said that it couldn't happen. If the gravity was strong enough to be seen at the LHC in run one, it would have already been seen in astrophysics, and it wasn't. So they knew that it could be seen at the LHC, but it wouldn't have been seen in run one. So these people are kind of neutral. They were not expecting to have seen anything yet, but they are looking forward to see something at the run two, because energy is that you can't. There's no substitute for energy. The more energy you have, the more chance you have of seeing these kinds of changes to the standard model. Next slide. So what's the bottom line? Those are kind of what people are hoping to see, and hopefully they're all wrong. But that's I think what the best picture we have. Next slide. So the main thing I think is that the LHC has already changed how we think about physics. It's been running, it had a very successful run one, and it's running at its design energy now for the first time, and it has been for about a month or so. Next slide. Now, the one thing they've done for sure in run one was they found something new, a new particle at 125 GeV that walks and talks and smells like a Higgs and probably is a standard model Higgs. And more evidence will come in on that, because there's plenty of energy available to produce these Higgses, and they're going to get more and more and more of them. And so the more they get, the more they can nail down how accurately it decays into various things, and the more they'll be able to tell, is it really doing what the standard model says, or is it doing something else? Next slide. So even if it's not the Higgs and it's a Higgs, one of the take-home messages is that this Higgs mechanism thing is right. And theorists are not very surprised by that. So at some level, that's a big yawn for theorists, because since the 60s, the only way we've been able to figure out how to get masses out of these theories that we have for particles is that there's something like the Higgs mechanism going on, where the vacuum has physical properties. But that doesn't make it a big yawn, really, because that was a big theoretical limb that we've been out on since the 60s. So that's like for 60 years or 50 years. And now there's experimental evidence that it's right. And so this Higgs mechanism seems like it's the right way to think about the vacuum, and it's a very deep statement about the vacuum. Next slide. So now, the higher energies will tell us what to do, and that's the thing that what's happening now is the experimentalists are putting out papers where they're doing their last analyses of the previous run, because they're going to be busy with the new run soon. And what happens is that the last things they put out are the ones that were hardest to understand, and those are the ones that are the most different from the standard model. So what's happening is that the papers that are coming out now are anomalies. They're all claiming that there's a 2 sigma or there's a very low statistical significance difference from the standard model, and most of those will go away. And they're coming out now because what they do is, if something disagrees with the standard model, they look at it very, very, very carefully until they run out of time, and now they run out of time. So what you should watch is the news probably probably next, around February or March is when the conferences are, that they will have had enough time to really study things and to see whether or not these anomalies go away. If there is a difference from the standard model happening, they may be seeing a hint of it already, but it should be accumulating as time goes on, as they run between now and next winter. They'll probably see things, if there's things that are very different from the standard model, they could see them immediately. They may have seen them already, but they're not going to believe them, because as soon as they see something like missing energy, the first thing they're going to think is, oh, we've got a problem with our detector. And so it takes them a long time to sort out that they're really seeing something and it's not just some detector artifact. But normally that process takes about, if there's a big thing that they've seen right away, we'll hear about it probably, you know, Christmas or so. And so there should be rumors starting in the fall. So keep your eye out, because it'll be very exciting if they see something. Those of us who've been waiting for decades for this to happen are just can't wait. That picture of Calvin Hobbes just sums it up completely. We're just waiting for it to happen, and I hope that it does. So thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yeah, I can't see you guys, but I can hear you fine, yeah?
Okay, fantastic. That was excellent. Thank you. We'll have a few questions now. So does anyone have any questions for Cliff? Okay, Tim, I'll just come over.
Hiya. Just wondering, in what way does the Higgs boson differ from the four fundamental force bosons?
Mostly in a spin. So it's all the other ones are spin one particles, except for the graviton, which is spin two. But in the standard model, all the other ones are spin one. And so the Higgs is, the only difference really is it's spin zero. But the modern picture is that anything that's the main thing is it's a boson. And the difference between a boson and a fermion is that fermions are like electrons. They don't like to, you can't have two of them in the same state, so they don't like to accumulate. But bosons are the opposite. They love to be in the same state. And so what happens is that's how you get forces to happen, is that you have something which produces a boson, it likes to produce two, it likes to produce three, and if there's not much energy cost, you can produce a whole bunch of them, and then that's how they start to mediate forces between one another. So essentially any boson will mediate a force, and it turns out that bosons all have spins that are integers. So there's 0, 1, 2, 3, or whatever. And the only real difference experimentally about the Higgs is that it happens to be spinless rather than having a spin.
Hi, I want to know when those protons, they collide, when you are looking for what comes in that shower, what kind of conservation laws are used, like energy, momentum, charge, mass, what kind of laws are used to try to identify what we should see after the collisions?
So the use, you listed almost all of them. So they look for energy and momentum. And they look for angular momentum conservation, and they look for charge conservation, electric charge. And then it turns out that angular momentum has a subset. You can think of helicity, which is like if you distinguish orbit, you know, or angular momentum due to the motion of the particles from their intrinsic spin. In some situations, those things are separately conserved. But that's almost all the conserved things that they really can take to the bank. Another one, I guess, is color. So if particles that carry the strong force, they carry a charge called color, and that's conserved. But that one you don't normally see very much, because all the particles we actually measure are colorless, because if you had color, you would bind with something else to become colorless to make a, because it's the same thing. You know, atoms tend to be electrically neutral, because if they weren't neutral, they would attract something with charge to make them neutral. And so you tend to find that the stable bound states are charge-free. And so What they're tracking at the end of the day are momentum, energy, angular momentum, and electric charge are the main ones.
With the Higgs mechanism now shown to be consistent, and the consequences of the structure of the vacuum, how are the cosmologists using that in early universe cosmology?
Well, it makes a big difference. The analogy with water is a good one, because if you imagine in the early universe, the universe was hot. And if we were surrounded by water and you heated the universe and it was water, it would evaporate at some point. So what people expect to happen is several phase transitions there should have been several phase transitions in the early universe, one of which would have been all the first one that you hit after as you move up in temperature as you go back in time, there should have been a phase transition where all the things that are bound into nuclei should become unbound. So there's what they call a deconfinement phase transition. So quarks and gluons would be free to move around, and we would not only see colorless things if we were above this temperature where the deconfinement phase transition happens. And then at even higher temperatures, there should be an electroweak phase transition where the Higgs vacuum goes away, that the Higgs field that's in that we see around us would actually disappear. And in that above that temperature, the W and the Z boson, which are massive, would become massless. They'd look exactly like the photon. So it would look like you had a whole bunch of particles that were identical to one another. So it'd be a much more symmetric place. And so in cosmology, people try and they take it for granted that those things happened. And then the question is there any observable consequences of that? And so far, there's been no observational proof that they've happened. But one of the big puzzles that they have in cosmology is to understand why is there anything in the universe at all? Because one of the charges in the previous question, when we're listing charges, I forgot one. One of the charges that is conserved in the standard model is baryon number. It's a number of protons and neutrons, say, minus the number of antiprotons and antineutrons, but doesn't count electrons. That's also conserved, it turns out. And it turns out that the fact that we see particles around us and not antiparticles tells us that the universe seems like it has a net baryon number. And that's kind of weird. It's a very small baryon number. Right now, there's no antiparticles, but in the past, there would have been lots and lots of antiparticles. And the baryon number is the difference between the particles and antiparticles. So for there to be no antiparticles now means that if we went back to the early universe, there would have been something like billions and billions and billions of particles, and there would have been billions and billions and billions of antiparticles minus one. And then that difference is what survived now to be the particles that we see. So a big problem has been to understand why should the universe have been set up in that way. And what people believe is probably is that baryon number is not exactly conserved. It was really the baryon number of the universe was zero, and that baryon number got generated somehow. So the antiparticle difference originally was zero, but now it's turned out to become non-zero because of some history of the universe thing. And in that story, these phase transitions play an important role. So people have been searching to try and find a way of finding evidence that these phase transitions happened, and the best scenario so far is in trying to understand why there's more particles than antiparticles in the universe. It seems like that might be related, but no one really has a convincing picture yet.
Okay. When you double the energy of collisions, by what factor does that change the number of collisions you want to see?
I'm not sure what you mean. So the energies are like just like 14 TeV per collision, and then given that...
So the collisions that you're looking for, will they double? For the doubling of energy?
Oh, you mean for a particular theory? Like if you have extra dimensions, for example, how much energy do you need to see them? Is that what you mean?
No, but I'll go with that.
Well, what happens is the energy is kind of deceptive because the proton is really a collection of constituents like quarks and gluons. And so when you collide two protons at 7 TeV each, what really happens is that the collision that has the most... produces the most particles are the ones of the constituents. So it's like if you had two garbage cans firing at each other, it'll be an apple core against an apple core, which makes the big collision. And most of the time, not much happens to all the other things. And so if you kind of look at a subset of a specific quark inside a proton, it's not carrying all the energy. And so the energy that's actually available in most collisions is less than the total 14 TeV because of that. And so there's a distribution that depends on how much any one quark is carrying of the proton's total energy. So there's a kind of a range of energies that's available in these collisions. And then if you have a particular theory, what typically happens is that the rate for producing some new exotic particle goes like a power of the energy, like maybe it goes like energy squared or something like that. And so the more energy you have, that means the more collisions you're going to get. And if you have, 10 times the energy, you're going to get 100 times the number of particles being produced in the example that the cross section goes like the energy squared. And so what people normally do is they say, well, if I have some sort of a theory and you're telling me I have so much energy available in these collisions, I should be expecting to see such and such number of particles being produced that are new and would have these properties. And then if you don't see them, then what you know is that in that theory, the cross-section, whatever the numbers were in front of the energy squared, they had to be small enough that, the rate of producing the things that you say you're producing was small enough that it wasn't detected. And so they turn it into a constraint on the properties of the theory. And so the hope is that because these exotic things are produced by cross sections that are with rates that grow with energy, like some strong power of energy, that you can't really hide it if you get to high enough energies. And there will be a trade-off at some point where it'll always be possible for theorists to choose parameters in such a way that we didn't get quite high enough at 14, and maybe if we got to 20, that might have been better. but the hope is that you can exclude most of the theories with the energies that are available. But it's kind of hard to really pin down a really smoking gun if you have to have seen all possible ways of writing this theory with the collisions that are available. It's kind of I think I'm making a hash of this question, so you might want to ask it again if I'm not really addressing it.
Will the Higgs boson explain the mass of the neutrinos if it turns out that they have a mass, of course?
Oh, it could. So that's actually there's kind of a favorite theory there as to how you change the standard model for the neutrinos, and in that theory, the neutrinos the favorite theory is what they do is they say, well, there's actually three more neutrinos we don't know yet. So there's a total of six rather than just three of them. And in that theory, what happens is that the other three that we haven't seen yet, they get a mass which has got nothing to do with the Higgs particle, but they also talk to the three that we do see because of their interactions with the Higgs particle. So the answer to your question is, in the best theories that we have, the Higgs plays a role, but not the whole. It's not the whole story of the mass. So it could be that there are some theories where the total mass of the Higgs comes from mass of the neutrinos comes from the interactions with the Higgs, but it can't be through the interactions that the standard model gives you. You can design theories where the neutrinos interact with the Higgs in a different way, and they get a mass from that new interaction, or you can design theories where there's new particles. And those new particles interact with neutrinos and the Higgs in a way which gives them a mass. So the Higgs normally plays a role in most of the theories we have for neutrino mass.
Okay, next question. One of the further developments for the LHC is instead of proton collisions, they're going to be injecting lead nuclei. So they'll be 82 plus charged. So practically, how does that difference in charge affect what they need to do in the tunnels in order to make them accelerate in the same way? And then how does that affect the energy that the lead nuclei will have in comparison to proton collisions?
So good question. So the ALICE detector that was in one of the first pictures was kind of designed to see these heavy ion collisions. You're right. And they have a mode where they stop using protons and they put in the heavy ions. And what happens is that so the ions will have much, much more energy than the protons did. And what they normally count is the energy per nucleon when they talk about these heavy ion collisions, because that's kind of the thing that counts as how much energy is released in the reactions that they produce. So those ions themselves will have more energy, but the kind of the energy that will count will be the energy per nucleon, and that's kind of similar to what the protons had. And really what's, you know, the answer I'm going to give you is a particle physics answer, and you'd get a different one from a nuclear physicist. And what happened was that at one point they ran out of money when they wanted to build the LHC. And so what they did is they went to the particle physicists went to the nuclear physics community and said, can you help us build the LHC? And they said, yes, if you let us run it as have a heavy ion collider for a while. And so that's what happened. And so from the point of view of the particle physicists, when they run it, they turn off the protons, and they don't have to change too much, but they change a little bit. The beam characteristics so they can run lead through it. But for the point of view of particle physics, it's off as far as we're concerned. And then we just wait for them to turn on again once the nuclear physicists. And that's because the nuclear physicists, there's physics that they're trying to get at. And mostly what they're trying to get at is they're trying to get at this deconfinement phase transition in that strong interactions have. So they have enough lead, there's enough strongly interacting particles all colliding together that they hope to actually go through that phase transition and measure its properties. And it's a difficult thing because there's many, many more particles flying around than there is in when the protons are colliding. So even the ones I showed that had lots of particles in them, that was just protons. And so the ALICE detector is designed to be able to track many more things than that, because they're really aimed at trying to pick apart all the different things that are coming out when they have many more particles, as they would when they collide lead. But because the energy per nucleon is less, it's not really anything exotic like a Higgs gets completely drowned in the noise in those kind of collisions. So it's very difficult to pick apart, because the initial state's so complicated, so it's difficult to pick apart the fundamental particle physics-y things that are interesting to us. So it's a compromise that kind of came about because of the way they funded it.
Okay, thank you for that. I have a question. This is Damien here. You're a theoretical physicist. What is your kind of pet theory? What do you think, or what do you hope will come out of the LHC once all the results from the full energy have come out? And also, follow-up question, are the rumors true that you've been making various wagers and bets with other physicists? And well, how are they going?
Yeah, the bets are true. And my the thing I propose is a minority. Almost nobody believes I'm right. So I demand odds. So my standard bet is a bottle of wine versus a case of wine. And I've been making these bets with people in Italy and in France and in Cambridge, where they have great wine cellars. And so it's if I win, it'll be great. If I lose. So you know, you might have been able to tell in the earlier slides that the slides, the only slides that were not unhappy were the ones I believe in. So the extra dimensions, I think, is what's going to happen. And I think the most people would say, I think, that the extra dimensions is something which is a logical possibility, but they don't find it very likely, in the sense that if you take a theory of gravity, like string theory, for example, as a theory of gravity, it allows you to have dimensions that are large enough that you could see them at the LHC, but it doesn't require you to have them that large. So most people would take the point of view that it's a possibility, but it's not such a compelling one. But my take on it is that, if in the list of problems that the standard model had, one of them is the cosmological constant problem, which is similar in spirit to the hierarchy problem. And it's a problem which I think most people would say there's no known solution to it. And that's unusual, because normally what happens is that if there's a problem, the theorist will give you five ways of solving it, and then you wait for the experimentalist to tell you which one is right. And the cosmological constant problem is a situation where there's no consensus that any one theory even theoretically solves the problem. So it's really kind of a puzzle as to why the dark energy, the problem is, why is the dark energy so small? The dark energy, the experiments that see dark energy in cosmology would be perfectly well explained if you just said that you're looking at the vacuum energy, and the vacuum should have an energy density. There's nothing that forbids it from having it, but the energy they're measuring is so incredibly small compared to what you predict quantum mechanics should say the vacuum energy should be, that no one really has a take on why it makes any sense. But my take on it is that what we're seeing, I think that the cosmological constant problem is telling us that we have to have extra dimensions and they have to be large, because I think basically the statement about the problem is what we think that there should be a large vacuum energy, but what they actually measure is not energy. They measure curvature when they measure dark energy. And so in four dimensions, everything is the vacuum is so symmetric that if you have any vacuum energy, it's an obstruction to having small curvature, and they measure small curvature. But if you have more than four dimensions, no one says that although energy has to curve something, it doesn't have to curve the dimensions that you see in cosmology. It could be curving the other dimensions. And there's examples of ways you can do that if you look at gravity with higher dimensions. So I think that although, you know, if I'm kind of trying to be fair, I think that I think it's fair to say that I haven't been able to find a specific solution that does everything in this class of theories. But I don't see any way to. I think the dark energy, the cosmological constant problem, there's no way, there's no approach that even has a chance that doesn't have extra dimensions that are that large. And so I think that the clue that everybody else has given up on because they can't see any way to solve, but that is most informative is the cosmological constant problem. And I think it's telling us that we have to have large dimensions. And so I think that what we're gonna see is the large dimensions story, and it'll be large dimensions with supersymmetry in it. So there'll be lots of particles in the dimensions, which the things you'd look for are missing energy, because particles will be lost into the extra dimensions. But there's also more likely that's actually hard to see, but the thing that's more likely to be seen is you know, gravity is going to be, if this is right, if the extra dimensions are right, quantum gravity is going to be in your face at the LHC. So string theory will become an experimental science at that point. And so I don't know any way of having the standard model in a theory like, so it depends on what you think quantum gravity is, but if I take string theory as being a concrete example of what it could be, I don't know any way of having quantum gravity at the weak scale without having excited versions of the standard model particles. Like if it's string theory, the standard model, the string excited versions of the standard model would all be there. So that would be, they should be looking for excited W's and Z particles that would decay into electrons. They should be easy to see, actually. So that's what I think they're going to see. They're going to start seeing excited standard model particles and missing energy because what they're seeing is quantum gravity become important because the extra dimensions are large. And so you can kind of see, just even describing it always sounds a little bit crazy. So that's why I get the odds on the bet.
Thank you very much for that. That was excellent. We might end up. So thank you very much for your time, everyone. I really enjoyed it. So I don't know if you can hear us, but just one last.